Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode number 34 for Monday, February 15th, 2010, Hacking Science. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Welcome, everyone, to Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, episode number 34. We're hacking space with Ariel Waldman from spacehack.org. And I was going to talk a little bit. We were going to talk about robots today, but I lied about that. But this is something that's really equally important and interesting. Involves robots in some sense, and we can talk about that a bit. Basically, we're going to be talking about the science of space exploration and making that process available to anyone, making it possible for anyone to be able to hack the dominant science paradigm. And so without any further ado, we're going to be definitely talking with Ariel Waldman, who runs SpaceHack. She's a digital anthropologist and is the founder of spacehack.org, which is a directory of ways to participate in space exploration and to encourage citizen science. She is also a sci-fi movie gadget columnist for Engadget and the founder of Cupcake Camp. Just like bacon, everyone loves cupcakes.
Indeed.
Indeed. But you've also, in your incarnations as a science communicator and community builder, you've worked at NASA. Can you tell us a little bit about how a digital anthropologist gets into space and NASA?
Yeah, I mean, it was fairly interesting. I had been watching a program called When We Left Earth on the Discovery Channel, and it was about the Apollo missions, and I thought it was really cool. And I told a friend of mine at the time that it was really cool and I would love to work for NASA, but I had no idea if they needed random people like me. And he put me in touch with someone that he knew at NASA, and that day I reached out to them just out of the blue. And that same day, they had just made a job description for someone exactly like me, someone who had worked in startups, who also knew how to do design work, a variety of different experiences that didn't include a formal science background. They specifically mm-hmm. wanted to get a perspective from someone outside of the NASA realm. And so I randomly got a job at NASA, and my life was forever changed.
Yeah, you say it's forever changed. I mean, has it put you onto the just focusing on the science track, on space? I mean, is that where you've been?
Yeah, it totally has, because I think a lot of people, of course, would say, of course I would want to work at NASA. Of course that would be cool, but there's no way I could. I'm not, you know, a physics PhD or anything like that. And
right.
And I think being able to do something changes the way you see it. And that's very much a big proponent of getting involved in space exploration, coming to the realization that actually you should be able to own space exploration on your own. It shouldn't be monopolized just by NASA. In fact, one of the most important things that I learned while I was at NASA was that I didn't need to be at NASA to be doing any of the science or space exploration participation stuff I was doing.
Right.
So you kind of don't need to work at NASA, and you don't need to be an astronaut to do a lot of the really cool stuff.
Which I think that's something that's really could be a real light bulb moment for so many people to hear that and to be able to put two and two together. Because you grow up and you think, oh man, you know, I'd love to be an astronaut. I'd love to go to space. I think that would be fabulous. But then, you know, one thing leads to another. You just don't go that direction. You have these childhood dreams that are smashed to dust and you never reach the moon. But suddenly, through technology and through the internet and through the power of this hacking and citizen science, you can do that.
Right.
You can reach that.
Yeah, definitely. I think that kind of gets to another core of what space hacking is about. It's because a lot of the technologies are advancing so quickly that people are able to now demand that they want space exploration on a cheaper and faster schedule. And so a lot of the work that's being done by citizen scientists or people who otherwise aren't in the science industry is kind of pushing it forward to get things done cheaper and faster and make it more accessible to everyone. So sort of the work that's being done in hacking into space exploration is benefiting the global good.
Can you tell us a little bit about the CoLab project that you worked on while you were at NASA?
NASA CoLab was a really great program, and it was the program that I got hired into with NASA. And it essentially existed to collaborate between communities inside and outside of NASA. So whether it be NASA reaching out to communities and being able to help them with their knowledge, or people being able to collaborate with scientists and being able to help them analyze data, a variety of things online and offline, CoLab kind of existed to be NASA's main effort to facilitate that collaboration.
Are there other, or is NASA working on any other projects now that are similar to CoLab, or are they, I mean, are they branching out since beginning this kind of social media experiment?
I think now, definitely a lot of the values of NASA CoLab and a lot of the aims of what they're doing is slowly sort of going through the veins of NASA. Mm-hmm. So there are certain parts of NASA that are looking at NASA CoLab as a case study for how do you interact and collaborate, and how do you sort of move NASA forward by growing your community. Mm-hmm. And so I think even though there's not a dedicated program to it anymore, I think it's filtering its way through the whole agency.
What are you working on right now that you're really excited about? With Space Hack, there are tons of projects that you're telling people about and informing people about. What are you working on that you're most excited about right now?
As far as Space Hack projects or just in general?
Let's start with Space Hack projects, and then we can maybe get to more general.
Well, one of my favorite Space Hack projects that I don't personally work on, but I am constantly in touch with a lot of the people there, is Galaxy Zoo. Galaxy Zoo is a way of classifying galaxies online. Anyone can do it. It's an easy sign up. You just go to galaxyzoo.org, sign up, and you can instantly start classifying galaxies and identifying them. And it's 3 to 6 buttons, so it's a fairly easy interface. But they also have a little button on there that says, do you see anything unusual? So you can say things like, well, I've looked at 1,000 galaxies or so, and this one looks really unusual. I want to investigate it further. And they give you the full spectrum data and everything behind it. And so they allow people to actually discover galaxies, because a lot of the imagery that you're looking at quite possibly hasn't been seen by human eyes before. It's pulled directly from the the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And so people are able to go on there and actually make discoveries. And so it's not about being a mechanical Turk for a bunch of scientists. The discoveries actually get credited to you. And it's why it's one of my favorite projects is because it requires such a low learning curve. Kids can do it. So many people can do it. But it's easy, but it allows you a lot of data access. And because of that, people feel like they can investigate further into it and actually become more of a scientist by getting involved in it.
Yeah, I'm looking at, I've got the Galaxy Zoo up on the screen right now, and if you go in, and it gives you the option to classify. It's a quick link to classify. And it pops up with an image, and you choose the kind of features that you see. Is it simply, it asks the question, is the galaxy simply smooth and rounded with no sign of a disk? And then you choose what it looks like. And it'd probably ask you different kinds of questions that you then...
They do have tutorials on there to kind of walk you through how to classify things. So if you go on there and you feel a bit intimidated by it, they've got tutorials. The other great thing is their forums. They've got a really lovely community of people who are... really into classifying galaxies, some with science background, some without. But going on to the forums, people are very welcoming there. So if you have any questions or are unsure about anything, they're very open to having conversations about all of it.
Yeah, this seems like a very, it's a basic interface. It's really simple. So you're just given three choices and you kind of match. You're using your pattern recognition abilities as a human to be able to match the type of galaxy that you're looking at and be able to help classify these trillions of galaxies that are out there?
There's a lot. I think, how many are in this one? I think in the 2000s, they were capturing 1 million galaxies.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why a lot of this is very important is because there's so much data out there that needs to be analyzed on a human level. But mm-hmm. as technology progresses, we're taking in more and more data, and we still need to analyze it through a human eye, because robots, as much as I love them and they're cool, they're actually kind of dumb.
Right.
So they have like 1 million galaxies to classify in the 2000s. And I think they're going to soon be launching one of the lunar surface, and that's going to have 60 million images. So,
wow.
So
you need lots of eyeballs looking at it. And I think the great thing about this, you can be any age. You can, mm-hmm. Anybody who has an internet connection and can download these images, can be able to have input on research. I mean, this is contributing to science.
Yep.
Yeah. Do you think there is I think I get the question of people contributing to science. I mean, is this something that is really important?
Yeah, I mean, it is really important because you are contributing to actual science. And so that's kind of one of the points that I set up with spacehack.org is it's not just about saying, hey, NASA, I think you should go to the Mars instead of Moon. And, you know, maybe NASA will look at your feedback and maybe that might influence a decision. It's about actually doing stuff that makes actual contributions to science. So you are actually becoming part of science history, I suppose, by expanding global knowledge to it. And I mean, I don't know. I think a lot of people would love to be listed as the discoverer of some new galaxy or something else, or the creator of a new rover. But currently there's this sort of elitism towards science that you have to, you know, have all these degrees and formal background to be able to do that. And that's just simply not true anymore. So,
yeah, well, there are certain aspects to training and being trained in a particular field and a particular methodology. And sometimes that's what the advanced degree signifies, is that you've spent time focusing on something to the point where you understand the methodology and how to ask questions and how to put things together. And there's a place for that, but there's also a place for people who are just interested in helping in some way.
Right. Yeah. And Galaxy Zoo actually did a survey of a lot of their active users. It was a 11,000 person survey, and they asked, what's the most related science activity you do in addition to classifying galaxies? And there were a variety of different options, some more into science than others, but over 80% of the 11,000 people who responded, the most related science activity that they did was just watching cool science stuff on TV. So these were people exactly like me who watched something awesome on TV, said, oh, I want to do that. These people are out there and they haven't yet been really tapped into as far as you can do this and you can get involved at any level you want, and you shouldn't feel like there's a barrier to it.
Yeah. At what point did you start Space Hack?
I started Space Hack almost immediately after I left NASA in 2008, I believe. So I left NASA, and then I spent pretty much the 2 weeks afterwards building Space Hack, and I continue to manage it today.
Got an issue with the color here. For audio podcast listeners, this is not going to be an issue, but for the live feed, everyone who's looking at the live feed right now, it's in black and white. We're looking at spacehack.org on the website, her website. And as it says, it's a directory of ways to participate in space exploration, interact, and connect with the space community. And what kind of things do you pick?
I pick things that go around active contribution. So back to what we were saying about being able to actively make a difference in science instead of just being able to, you know, talk about it, and things that are disruptively accessible. So things that are disrupting the current state of the science industry and making it accessible to a wide variety of people. Things that allow for open collaboration, which is incredibly important because people are really happy about open source, and open hardware and open software are really important. But I believe that it doesn't truly make it open unless you have open collaboration and open community. So you're allowing a diverse set of backgrounds to actually contribute to something, because open hardware and open software, they're really great, but they still have a fairly high learning curve to them. So by having projects that allow people with different sets of backgrounds to contribute, it's really allowing for a lot of open collaboration to take place.
One of the projects on here that I think is something we've talked about previously that is really opening up space in a real way is this, you've got on your website on the top row, TubeSat, personal satellites. Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yeah, so TubeSats are pretty cool. I guess I would first start off with giving an introduction to CubeSats. CubeSats are these very small satellites that can fit in the palm of your hand. They're a bit larger than your hand. They're about 10 centimeters. They're these cubes, a bit larger than a Rubik's cube, maybe like 4 Rubik's cubes or so.
Right.
And they're designed around the PC-104 board. So they're just these small cube satellites. And people often launch them to do various experiments on them. And they are slowly becoming more accessible to people. So you see a lot of universities sending them up, et cetera. The problem is that they are still, when I say slowly more accessible, they are anywhere from $50,000 to $1 million to build and launch.
Most of that is the actual rocket launch, right?
Right. So about $8,000 for the parts, and then the rest goes to the rocket launch. So they're, you know, a fairly, you kind of need an investor to do one still at this point. However, the TubeSat kit is a step down from that, and it's the same idea, same sort of size, only tube shaped, and it's an experimental launch idea where they're going to load a lot of TubeSats onto one rocket. So for $8,000 USD flat, you can get all the parts to the TubeSat, build it yourself, and launch it on a rocket. So pretty much you're getting the rocket launch for free. And so that's pretty cool. I think people are a little bit skeptical about how the launch will go since it's a fairly experimental one and it hasn't been launched yet. But I think it's something, as with a lot of things in space hacking, where if you get enough people interested in it, I think it's going to contribute to the success of it.
Right.
So there's that. So that's, again, $8,000 USD to be able to do. So it's slowly making it more accessible. And I've personally never been so tempted to spend $8,000 all in one go. So
really?
Yeah, it's pretty tempting. They're not the cost of an iPod yet, but one day.
But one day. Yeah. I mean, and the fact that they're small, they can be modular. They can you can incorporate small experiments into them. You can make them what you want them to be. I think it really is going to end up allowing so many different people to have access to it. I mean, school kids, if you can somehow find a way to, get $1,000 or $8,000 together at your local school, you can school kids could send up a TubeSat or a CubeSat if they can get involved in a launch of a,
Right. And there's even cheaper options that are out there that a lot of people have been experimenting with. There's the SpaceDuino.
Right.
As some people have been calling it, and that's about $150 to test. And it's not exactly the same, but it's a good first step. A SpaceDuino is essentially a styrofoam box that you put a camera and an Arduino and a battery in it. And you attach it to a weather balloon and you launch it to the through the weather balloon. You launch it to the edge of space, which is about 100 kilometers up. And you're starting to see students doing this for fun. Some hacker spaces in San Francisco have been doing it recently.
I was just trying to figure out if I could find some pictures of the recent Noise Bridge
launch.
It's
on Laughing Squid today, I think, actually.
I'll find it.
But so they're able to, for $150, get the first step into thinking about how you have to deal with hardware when you're dealing with really cold temperatures at which most of our technologies that we use are going to stop working. So it's a fairly good experiment to get involved and try it out. And, if it breaks, it's $150. So it's not a huge, loss, as much at least.
Yeah, I mean, that's a more affordable loss. Yeah, here on Laughing Squid, it's talking about Noisebridge having a space program.
Right, yes.
Which
they got close to that. They got about a fifth of the way up to the edge of space. So
that's pretty.
And that was the first attempt. That was the Alpha launch. So they're definitely going to do it again. And yeah, there's the photo of them launching it.
Yeah, and with you can't just go around launching a weather balloon, though.
No, you definitely need to. There's a lot. So, talking about open collaboration at Noisebridge, the hackerspace that did this over the last weekend, they had people from all different backgrounds giving advice. So you had ham radio people talking about how to track it. You had different people who understood GPS, APRS, all these tech abbreviations, some that I'm not familiar with. But you have to talk to the FAA, and there's different regulations depending on where you are about cloud coverage and where you can launch and where you can't. And apparently there's some rules about once you get
all right.
way above a flying plane level that they don't care as much, but when you're in that in-between level, they seem to care a lot about where you are.
Which makes sense. You yes. are something that is...
We just launch satellites whenever we want to.
You're going up into airspace without a transmitter letting them know that you're there. So
a lot does go into it, but you should definitely talk to people and figure out the legalities of what it is to launch these things. Stay safe and everything.
Yeah, stay safe. And this is actually something that's near and dear to my heart right now. With This Week in Science, my radio show, we're actually considering putting together a project, partnering with a company who has the know-it-all to kind of make it happen, get the back end of it going, to actually launch a CubeSat. So we are actually considering doing this and trying to harness the power of the community to make it happen. So the $50,000 to $1 million that it's going to take, we're hopefully going to be able to raise that through the community to be able to make it an endeavor that everybody can get into and get behind. And it's a community project and not just one person trying to do it.
Definitely. Yep.
Yeah. Now, in terms of other projects, I mean, SpaceHack has so much stuff on it. I'm looking at the main page, and there's the Lunabotics mining competition.
Yep.
Tell me a bit about that.
That one I just put up on SpaceHack. It's very similar to the NASA Regolith competition, which is a centennial challenge. But the Lunabotics is essentially the same idea, building a robot, either teleoperated or autonomous, and building a robot and having it excavate lunar regolith, which is the rocks and soil on the lunar surface. And so being able to build a rover, robot, some sort of contraption that can excavate the lunar regolith and carry it. This is important because a lot of us are trying to figure out how to bring more regolith back to be analyzed. These sorts of things help contribute to figuring out how to build lunar outposts on the moon and all different sorts of really cool things.
Yeah.
So these sorts of projects are more aimed at people who might have an interest in robotics, and they do allow for teams. So it is possible that a team who had like someone who knew robotics and someone who knew something else would come together and build something for this. So I would rate this a little bit higher on the learning curve, but definitely for people who really like robots, this is like
robots
really
and space.
Yeah.
You got the moon.
If you're going
to
build a robot, it should be a space robot. It's just,
why not?
It would be disappointing otherwise.
But there are lots of things that go into building electronic devices that can survive in outer space the moon with no atmosphere.
Right. Yeah. They have to take into consideration a lot of things, the vacuum of space, the weight ends up being really important. When you're talking about these sorts of robots, they can only weigh a certain amount. They can only carry a certain amount. So it's not the same as just,
building a robot.
A bulldozer on the moon and then, oh, I won the competition. It's a bit harder than that. Yeah.
Yeah. There. What's the other? Google has a Lunar X Prize, doesn't it?
Yeah. Google Lunar X Prize. Very awesome thing. Google Lunar X Prize is a $30 million competition to send a robot to the moon, send data back, and do a bunch of cool stuff. And it's an international competition, something that I try and get tons more. I really want Space Hack to be internationally focused. And unfortunately, with a lot of the NASA-sponsored stuff, it has to be U.S. only. So Google Lunar X Prize is awesome because it's completely international, and teams are building all different types of spacecraft to send to the moon and transmit data back. So they have to figure out the robot. They have to figure out also the launch, if they're going to piggyback on someone else or if they're going to try and build their own launch, which I believe one of the teams is doing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's an amazing endeavor. I can't imagine trying to build a robot and a rocket in the same time frame. But
yeah,
they're doing all this. And so there's great teams from all over. And there's a Chinese team, I think, which has like a rocket sled sort of approach, like a lunar sled. There's a Romanian team who's doing like a more spherical sort of robot thing. There's all sorts of different things. But essentially, the purpose of Google Lunar X Prize is to push space exploration on a faster and cheaper schedule. So being able to actually change the way science is done. And a lot of teams are taking this fairly seriously because they're able to try and work harder on deep space communications and various other side projects of building the rover that can help push the science forward faster.
Right. I'm going to have to take this chance, this opportunity, to take a break and thank our sponsor for this show. Dr. Kiki Science Hour, this episode number 34, Hacking Space, is brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of audio books. It has a huge library, more than 60,000 titles to choose from, all sorts of different genres. My favorite genre being science. They do have science books that you can read and enjoy, love. But there are many others, science fiction, probably several titles on some aspect of space, maybe even robotics, maybe hacking. For any listeners of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour, Audible is offering a free audiobook download to those of you who would like to give it a try, to give membership with Audible a try. And one audiobook that you might consider downloading, if you want to give it a try, the Twist Book Club this month is reading The Earth After Us. It's a book about the legacy. What will be left after humans are left behind? It asks that question. It's by Jan Salavit, I can't say his last name. I will try and pronounce it better another time. Let's see if I can get his name, Zalasiewicz. And it's a great book about what traces of human civilization are going to be left 100 million years in the future. So Earth After Us. There's another book title that's very similar by Alan Weisman called... what is it called? I forget what the other book is called, but there's another book, very similar idea, a couple of books out there about how the earth, how geology, how geological processes, how decomposition, how ecological processes will continue long after we're gone. And then what we have created so far in our existence that will be left, what'll be around 10,000, 100,000, a million years from now, anything? Will any future alien civilization or humans that leave the planet and to go exploring and come back millions of years in the future, will they find anything of the previous human civilization that was here? We don't know. That's what these books are about. So if you want to take a listen to one of those books, it's an option. And to download an audiobook from audible.com and download it for free, you should go to audiblepodcast.com/Kiki. Visit audiblepodcast.com/Kiki and download your free audiobook trial. Do you have any books that you think are really interesting relating to space and hacking? Or hacking or anything that you've read recently that you
really...
Well,
there's a lot of great hacking books out there. I know Instructables has a hacking book, and pretty much anything from Make is always a solid hacker's book. As far as space hacking, I don't really know if there's a book yet. I know there's a Space Tourist book, but that's a bit different.
Maybe this is your book.
Yes.
Maybe this is your book to write. It's very possible. So do you think that this, that engaging, to get back to our conversation about hacking space, about getting people interested in space, do you think that getting people interested in these citizen science space projects is easier or harder than other areas of science?
I think with space, it's actually fairly easy because space tends to be something in the sciences that is seen as sort of the cool kid, or at least when I've been going to science conferences, a lot of the people I meet tend to say that, oh, astronomy has it easy because everyone's mm-hmm. always interested in it and it's exciting to everyone.
Right.
So they do get kind of, space in general does get kind of a reputation for being really cool. And I mean, it, you know, let's be honest, it is. You know, but there's
and,
other...
And actually, physically, it's quite cold.
Right, and physically, it's quite cold. Yes. Yeah. But there are a lot of cool things being done in science, in other science realms that are very similar to space hack. I've heard of DIYBio.org, and they do sort of biology hacking and different things. And I'm not as familiar with all of these different sciences, but I think there's just a general effort to create, have more projects available, because I think a lot of people are realizing that there is sort of a citizen science renaissance going on.
Yeah.
And people are realizing that they should have access to these things.
I think it's really interesting that, I mean, the 50s, 60s were famous for chemistry kits, you know, that kids would get that were full of all these really toxic chemicals. Mm-hmm. And now we have, you know, they're all controlled substances. The chemistry kits are fairly simple. They're not as exciting to play with. And I think like the 80s and 90s went through this period of kids not doing as much science at home.
Yeah, I think that's something that gets talked a lot about amongst scientists is the fact that a lot of science is losing ground. But I think, you know, there's some truth to that. And there's also truth to the fact that what excites people is not always being taught to kids. And so that's always a growing problem that people have. Because there's so many things that I've learned as an adult and working at NASA, one of the best things about working at NASA is you're pretty much getting paid to go to school. You get to sit right. in on all these lectures and learn from the top scientists around the world. And it's really lovely.
Yeah, note to anybody out there, I'd love to do an internship at NASA.
They have them.
I want to work at NASA.
I think JPL is currently taking internship applications if you want to move to LA.
No. I don't know if I want to move to LA. I don't even know if I mean, I do the drive up here to Petaluma. I don't know if I want to drive even down to Ames.
So, you know, I was given access to all this information at NASA, but I grew really angry that there was so much stuff that I wasn't taught as a child. There was so much stuff about, you know, what happened before Pangea, how many times life tried to start on Earth before it got completely wiped out, you know, way before the dinosaurs. You know, that our Earth used to look like a snowball. There's certain things where if you tell that to a kid, that's really cool stuff.
Yeah.
But instead, they have you doing lab work and learning processes. And that stuff is really important to learn. But some of the excitement gets lost in all the mixing around.
Yeah. And even just they don't always have you doing lab work either. It's read this chapter of this book and then answer this, you know, 50 question true or false multiple choice test.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely hard. I don't mean to critique the education system too hard because you have so much to cram in, and being able to prioritize what's going to help a child learn is really difficult. So I think there's just a lot of really cool stuff out there, and different people get excited about different things. So making sure this sort of information is accessible if someone becomes excited about a certain part of science is really important.
Yeah. Do you think that that there are lots of challenges to making this stuff work? Or are there lots of challenges to things like the lunar botics or the Google? I mean, Google they have money to throw behind right. stuff for their X prize. You know, or even NASA. I mean, there are probably lots of internal challenges there, but what kind of challenges do you think are the major ones?
There are definitely challenges in setting up these sort of science hacking projects, and it really varies depending on what you're wanting to do. With Google Lunar XPRIZE, yes, they have funding. There's the XPRIZE Foundation, which has funding. They're able to run these sorts of programs, so they're mm-hmm. able to actually build a community and do the outreach and really interact with people to make sure it's a successful thing. But going back to Galaxy Zoo again, that started with one student who was asked to classify 50,000 galaxies and got really sick of it. And
said, why do I have to do this? There has to be a better way.
Yeah, there has to be a better way. And that's
how can I get other people to do my work for me?
Yeah, pretty much. And then he got six or seven volunteer developers, and they created this site together, and it took off. And then I think probably the money came a little bit later for them as far as any funding that they're getting. But I think it really depends. I think, you know, to do something at the Google level, I think you do need dedicated people who understand communities, who understand collaboration, mm-hmm. Who actually can facilitate it into being a successful thing. However, there's so much open source data out there on NASA's websites and the ESA's websites. And just Googling for, you know, open source NASA will get you the web pages and the data that you need. But there's no communities built around these things. So they're not really open until someone takes the initiative to, you know, do something with it and build a cool project. And, you know, I would say it's about as accessible as it is to create a web page. I'm no hardcore developer, and I created Space Hack, and it's a fairly simple setup. So it really depends. And I think just doing it is the important part, because a lot of the funding that you might need later is going to come when you create something. It's not going to come by you telling people you have this really cool idea, but you have nothing to show them.
Yeah.
So there's challenges, but I think it's fairly accessible generally just to get people involved. The important thing is actually creating the open communities around any open data that you might have.
Yeah. Do you think that there's in terms of levels of involvement, do you think that it's easier to get kids involved, adults involved? Do you think both about the same, or do you think it's like adults bring the kids bring the adults?
I think it really varies. Typically, people assume that kids will be the ones that get interested, and I think there's so many programs across the United States, at least, to get kids involved in science, and they're well-funded, and the government funds it. There's so much effort to get kids involved in science, and I think a lot of people who are adults get left out of this, because a lot of science-related people will view, oh, if you go to school for design, or if you go for some, you know, fashion or something like that,
we've lost you
forever.
You're not interested.
You're going to be interested in science, you know, and they get fairly upset over this. They view it as a child that they've lost, that somehow that child got misguided and they're doing something less important because they're not, you know, going for the science degree. So I think... I don't know about if adults are able to get more involved easily than children, but I know that is a personal effort of mine to target people who are young adults and to getting involved, because I, again, being able to do something changes the way you see it. And if you've been doing something else, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not interested in science. I think if you're interested in science as a kid, that's what you're going to go for.
Right, that you have that intrinsic interest, but that doesn't mean that if you're not interested in science as a kid, you're never going to be interested in it ever in your entire life.
Yeah, everyone has grown up thinking rockets and NASA was cool and going to the moon or Mars or, you know, wherever. I think we all consume all of this imagery growing up, from the Hubble Space Telescope to Apollo missions, and we have such a familiarity with this imagery, but we don't really ever interact with it. We can't ever tinker with that data.
So you look at the pictures online or in a book, and that's it.
They've ingrained into our society, but we're not really being able to tinker with this. And so it's kind of shifting that mindset that space hacking is about.
Do you think that there's I think that there are probably going to be different people who are doers and those that are viewers. Do you think that there's do you think that's just already ingrained into, say, American culture, that we can't tinker, and so maybe there are just those people who from the time they're little they wanted to tinker, and they so they find ways to do that, and other people who just don't? But is it going to be difficult to change that mindset?
I think there's definitely a lot of gray area. I think people who don't view themselves as doers, a lot of times, not all the time, but a lot of times it's because they're intimidated by it. They think they're going to break something. And so they just don't
I don't want to break it.
Right.
Yeah.
And, and some people are more hands-on and some people aren't. And personally, I was more of a visual learner. And when I was taken to sort of science museums growing up and they had a bunch of hands-on stuff, I was never really wowed by it. And so this goes to, you know, the diverse sets of backgrounds that you need to collaborate in science, because some people are interested in this stuff, but they want to come from it from different angles. So science doesn't always have to be a literal hands-on approach, because there are things, Stardust at Home, et cetera, where it's mouse clicks when you really get down to it.
Right.
But, you know, it's interacting with you on a more of an intellectual level. So I think it's not really if you're a doer or not. I think even if you don't view yourself as someone who would build a robot, that doesn't mean you can do it. I haven't built a robot yet. I would love to, but I haven't. And
That's something on the list, the to-do list.
Yeah, a lot of the doing stuff is also comes with privilege, because if you know someone who knows how to build a robot, it's going to be a lot easier for you to learn how to. But if you are in a community where you don't know anyone who's ever built a robot, it's really difficult. And this is true with programming. This is true with so much stuff. So it's important to tap into people who are around the world who have different communities surrounding them. Some people might be surrounded by developers, but others might be surrounded by, you know, financial workers. I don't know. It's really diverse. And so not being a doer is not a bad thing. It's more
sometimes just access,
right? It's access and getting involved in whatever way you feel comfortable.
I think, and you happen to be a doer. I've learned this about you. You happen to be one of these people who are a doer. And before we, you know, close out the show, I think the one of the things that people might we, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you started Cupcake Camp.
Yes.
Not necessarily scientific.
No.
But it's very much a doer activity.
Right. Yeah.
what went into you? What started in your brain about, hey, I need to start a cupcake collaboration?
Cupcake Camp was sort of a joke. It was based, I was with a few friends, and it was based off of, we were talking about bar camps, which are essentially user-generated conferences where people just show up. And everyone who shows up has to give a talk. And so the entire conference is put on by the people who attend it. And we were joking about, wouldn't it be cool to combine a bar camp with cupcakes? And it was a joke, but I was like, I'm going to try it. So I did. And the first one, we thought like 40 of our friends were going to show up, and 300 people showed up. And then it became a global phenomenon. And the last one we threw in San Francisco had over 700 people. And
wow.
Cupcakes are kind of awesome.
People love cupcakes. Yeah. And so it's a global phenomenon. People are this has spread, and there are cupcake camps being organized everywhere.
People have been planning and throwing them everywhere, from Bombay to the Philippines to Australia to Northern Ireland. Canada has had a ton of them. Canada's in love with Cupcake Camp, as far as I can tell.
Canada cupcakes.
Yeah. So they're really happening globally all over, and people are still throwing them. And I think it's just a really fun event, because people are, it's something, you know, you can't help but smile over. And cupcakes are such a great thing to meet new people by, because it's you have a common social object to sort of talk about without any you know, weirdness or anything.
Right. Has this turned it, is there any, I'm trying to think of how we can find a way to incorporate science into the cupcakes somehow. Science cupcake camp.
Yeah, we could do the anatomy of a cupcake or something.
With the bar camp kind of model, are you, do people presentations or talks about cupcakes, or is it basically just bringing their cupcakes
at,
in?
At the San Francisco one, it has been more about just people bringing cupcakes and eating cupcakes for free. However, at everyone in a different city takes it on a little bit differently. So there have been ones that do eating competitions. There's ones that do give presentations. There's ones that are a lot more strict about judging and
right.
And everything. So it kind of is able, the nice thing about BarCamp is that it's a very adaptable model, just as long as you keep the philosophy of keeping it free and keeping it fairly open. So it's great to see like how people are changing it each time.
Now, Cupcake Camp this year, still up in
TBD.
The air. TBD.
Yep.
To be determined for San Francisco, at least.
So yes.
If you look online, you can probably find a Cupcake Camp organizational committee in your local area, or
yeah,
you
well,
can start one.
Yes, start one. If there's, this goes back to the doing part of it. Like if you want a cupcake camp in your city, then you should do it. All the instructions are on cupcakecamp.org. If you click on the how-to part, it's quote unquote open source, how to make a cupcake camp in your own city, and it's all outlined there. There's a lot of instructions, so you can make it happen.
You can't. Now, this is the best decorated cupcake. Unfortunately, it's not in color here. White popcorn with carnival toppings for best decorated, and then we have cookies and cream cupcakes. Oh my goodness. Breakfast inspired.
Yep.
Oh my, Gruyere bacon mushroom with cream cheese frosting by Jackie Freeman. She's been in here a couple of times. We know Jackie. And French toast with bacon and maple. Wow. People have gotten amazing. This is amazing. Amazing creativity. I love it. I think this really goes, if we can find a way, it's the artistic creative spirit of people, that if you can find a way to get people excited around something that they love in common. And like you said, just something that is maybe just simple, or, as simple as a cupcake, you get people excited about that, and suddenly it creates a phenomenon. And this can be done in many different realms, including space or biology or geology. And maybe there are these communities of people. Maybe it won't be, 700 or 1,000 people at the San Francisco event, whatever it is, but at the same time, you can bring people together to talk about, to do, to create some kind of creative scientific endeavor.
Right. Yeah. It's definitely not the numbers that are important when you're talking about any of this stuff, because in so many cases, it only took one person to discover this amazing thing that forever changes the way science is done.
Yeah.
And it only takes one person to get really excited about cupcakes to start something. And so it is definitely not a quantity factor. If you end up creating your own science hacking sort of project and only 50 people are participating, then that's pretty amazing, because you have 50 people who might otherwise not know that they can be this involved. So,
right. And so you're passing the word, and you're communicating that aspect of involvement. I'm just wondering, how science will go on. There are scientists who are pushing the boundaries of science within the institutional realm. Science will continue, but there's this, this new world opening up of basically hacking the institution and trying to create a new way of approaching science that really is a return to the old way of doing science.
Right. Yeah. A lot of looking into some of science's best heroes, when you're looking at Charles Darwin or Thomas Edison, these people were either
Tesla.
These people were either self-funded or homeschooled, and they made amazing discoveries that have forever changed us. And when talking about science going on, I think science will definitely continue to go on, but I think a lot of people are critical of how it's moving forward, and there's been a lot of changes with NASA recently to address this on NASA budget cuts, etc. And I think by hacking into science, we're able to do this on a faster and cheaper schedule. Like, some government's going to go to the moon either way, but as the Google Lunar X Prize CEO has said, it's going to be many years and probably very expensive and with little public involvement. So by having things like Google Lunar X Prize and similar sort of hacking projects, we're able to push it faster and cheaper. And we
faster,
all,
cheaper, better.
Yeah,
let's take that NASA, that old NASA quote, and apply it to
We all want to see the most amazing stuff happen in our lifetimes, and some of that stuff won't happen unless we try to do this.
Right. So that's a note to everyone out there. Call to action. A call to action for everyone to take it into their own hands. And I think this is a great opportunity to start integrating this kind of citizen science activities into the classroom, or into, you know, weekend event, into your whatever you're doing on the weekend with your family, or, you know, there are all sorts of ways to fit things into your life. And possibly if teachers can get their eyes on these things, then it can be more fully integrated into the way that the kids that are growing up today think about their world.
Definitely. And there's a lot of projects on spacehack.org that target specifically only students. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of projects out there that are specifically either only for college students, only for high school students, only for K-12.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a lot of effort being made to make sure that people at all ages can interact with these things. And it's really great to see whenever schools are able to list these sorts of resources to children, giving them access to being able to actually do this stuff. Because I don't remember anyone pointing out this stuff when I was growing up, at least. So
No. It's a completely different world now, too, though, with the interwebs.
We're so old.
I know. No. No, we're not. No. we're as young as we feel inside. Or at least as young as our telomeres tell us we are. So we are going to be on a panel together at South by Southwest.
Yes.
Which I'm very excited about. So if you want to tell everybody what the idea behind that is.
Right now, I believe we just changed our title. So it should be called Open Science, Create, Collaborate, Communicate.
Yes.
So look out for that title. I believe we're going to be presenting on Monday at South by Southwest, which is in March in Austin. South by Southwest is a famous music festival, but they also have an interactive portion, which is insane. This will be my fourth year attending, I suppose. And it is like having the entire internet in person, and it's just as crazy as you would imagine. Anyone you've ever read or watch or anything on the internet, they are all there in person, and it's kind of really weird.
I'm gonna walk around and bump into get to people and be like, wait, I didn't click on your website, hold on, what are you doing here? I love that
spam.
I know.
So it's a really great conference. It's my number one conference choice each year. And we're going to be having a panel about open science, and talking a lot about how to get involved in science. So expanding beyond just citizen science, but different realms of it, the challenges that are faced in doing open science and allowing science to be more accessible to everyone. I have a feeling it's going to be really great. We have four women and one guy on our panel,
which I think is great. We have Jesse from NASA.
Jesse Cohen-Sharp from NASA. She was one of the creators of NASA CoLab, which we mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
She's now working on NASA's cloud computing platform, which is kind of leading the way for the federal government cloud computing.
Oh, that'll be interesting. I can't wait to talk with her about that.
We also have Natalie Villalobos. Mm-hmm. She's working at Google at SideWiki. She's just a really awesome person, super extroverted, always super passionate about various different projects. She's worked at Institute for the Future and all these really cool places. I couldn't even begin to ramble off all the cool places she's worked at. And then we also have Tantek Celik, who's going to be our moderator. He's the creator of microformats, and microformats are sort of these open pieces of code that you can embed in data. And that way you can make your data a lot more open, a lot more accessible on the web, mm-hmm. easily findable. He knows a lot more about it than I do, but he'll be a great moderator. So that's coming up in Austin in March.
Yeah, I'm excited about that. It's my first time going, so it's going to be an overwhelming experience for me, I'm sure. But
it will be really great. And I think the best part of it is that science is starting to infiltrate the technology culture a lot more. And by having this panel, we're going to, infiltrate it a bit more with science.
Yeah, I mean, that's the communication that needs to take place, is between people doing science, thinking about science and how to involve other people in it, and people who understand technology and are able to actually implement the ideas, who, you know, get these people together, get them talking, and maybe great things will come out of it.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's definitely been mind-blowing, because you have science and technology who are constantly infatuated with each other, yet surprisingly don't interact that much.
No, people are like, oh, scientists, nerds, technology people, geeks, they don't come together.
Right.
They don't meet in
the
middle.
So often I go, in my work situations, I'm either going into a science industry company and I'm the resident tech person, or I go to a science conference and you know, is vice versa, or I go to a tech conference and I'm sort of the science person there. And so there's very little interaction, which is just crazy. So I think there's a lot of work to be done into integrating science and technology more on a human level. I think there's a lot of great work that's being done in science and technology, but people-wise, you tend to see people on one side or the other. You don't see a lot of hybrid people.
That might change. I don't know. I'm thinking that as technology becomes more integrated into the way that we live our lives, and people thinking about technology and using technology and applying it, we're probably going to see more hybrids.
Definitely.
I think that's going to happen.
That's definitely a dream for the near future. I would love to see just people in Silicon Valley, especially since this is where I'm mostly located. You have so many science and technology companies. I would love to see them interacting more than they currently are. So,
yeah, maybe we can get that happening. What is your next? Do you have a next project? You have Space Hack, which I'm sure takes a lot of your time and your efforts. But is there anything that you're really, outside of Space Hack, excited about right now that you're moving forward on?
I think I'm just doing a lot of side projects and consulting at the moment. I think I'm at an interesting point where I'm open to new opportunities. Either, you know, will I go for the full-time job or will I stay consulting? I think right now, I think I just want to work on really exciting stuff. And I have a wide range of stuff that I find exciting. Everything in space hacking, I love, and I'll continue to do that no matter what I do. But I'm also really loving interaction design and my work in digital anthropology, so understanding how people are behaving with various digital mediums. I love all of that work.
Right.
I think the very nature of my background is that I jump from thing to thing and that I'm on various tangents. So I think I'm at another point where I'll probably go on a new tangent soon, but I will not give up my love for cupcakes, and SpaceX definitely is still going to be run all the time, no matter what. So
that's good to know. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been really great.
Yeah, thanks for having
me. Enjoyed talking with you. This has been so much fun. Everybody out there, if you want more information on hacking space, be sure to visit spacehack.org, and you'll get lots of information on projects that you can get involved in one way or another. And that's Ariel Waldman's website she founded and maintains. I'm Dr. Kiki, and this has been the Dr. Kiki Science Hour. And next week we're taking a break. I am going on a trip to Oklahoma to give a talk at their annual research week. So if you're around OSU for research week, try and find me. I'll be yapping away somewhere. Also, I'm going to be running around the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science annual meeting in San Diego next weekend. And I'll be speaking on Sunday on a panel about myth busting, which will be, it's a put together by Sense About Science, which is a UK science and skeptical and critical thinking organization. Beyond that, I'm trying to think of what else I'm doing. Beyond that, I'll be back here in 2 weeks on Twit, and we will be talking about actually implementing interesting technology and cool science projects into science classrooms. We have a science teacher from Davis, California, who will be joining us in studio to talk about all the cool things that he's been getting his students to do in the classroom, which I think it'll be an exciting, interesting show, at least. And I hope he brings some of the stuff with him so we can see what he's been working on. And until then, I'm Dr. Kiki. You can find me at on Twitter at Dr. Kiki, D-R-K-I-K-I. You can email me at drkiki@twit.tv. And if you need any more sciencey goodness, once Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is over, you can also find me at thisweekinsciencetwist.org. And I guess that's it. I'll see you in 2 weeks. Thanks for tuning into the Science Hour. Peace out.